Hi, folks. Welcome back once again to the Lex Rex Institute podcast. It's been a while this time.
That's true.
So, do we remember how to do this, David?
I think we can figure it out.
Well, let's hope so, at least.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting because we're technically finishing a series we were doing almost a year ago before.
That's right.
Things intervened and life got extremely busy for both of us, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah, so a lot's happened since we last spoke. I got married. Yep. Actually, David married me.
You mean that in the sense of officiating, we are not married to one another.
No, we're not. Yeah, that's correct. I'm married to Kristen, now Kristen Haberbusch. Very happily married. We just moved into a house in Long Beach. And yeah, things are going well, but obviously very busy as a result of many changes. David, I think you've finished your first couple semesters of your doctoral program now. Is that right?
Just about. I'm coming up on review board, which is sort of the important thing, but feeling pretty good about that. And that should be done in 3 or 4 weeks or so.
Oh, we were so confident in your qualifications to become a doctor, David, that we actually did name you as Dr. David Trushel in our wedding program.
That's true.
And we think that David's credit is as good as the real thing.
Yeah. So thanks for that, because I did have to explain that to a few people at the reception, which is not how I planned on spending that time, but here we are.
Well, you're very welcome, David. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take that as the compliment that it clearly wasn't meant as. And yeah. With that,
mm-hmm. Look at these three words written larger than the rest, with a special pride never written before or since. Tall words proudly saying, "We the people."
So today we're going to be discussing some matters related to criminal law, specifically policing theory, and you know, the apprehension of criminals, prosecution of criminals. I just want to say right off the bat, I am not a criminal lawyer. This is not my area of expertise. I do know the political philosophy behind it. I know some stuff about criminology, but this is not my area.
Yeah.
And if you've watched us before, you know that we're fairly critical of people who spout expertise outside their wheelhouse. So I don't want to suggest that I'm offering any expertise on the criminal aspects of this. What we're talking about is the theory of penology advanced by Jeremy Bentham as a legal theorist.
Yeah.
So any updates on our cases we want to talk about? There's been quite a few.
If we do want to do that, that'll have to come from you because I am a little bit out of the loop as of late. But if you have anything you want to share.
Understandably. David mm-hmm. is still in Scotland, for those mm-hmm. of you who don't remember. We do talk regularly, but I often talk about work enough that it doesn't come up. So,
yeah.
Well, one of the big ones we've been talking about a lot is our challenge to the Voter Choice Act in California. We're challenging that based on its contradiction to pre-existing law in the Elections Code. Basically, the issue is the Elections Code says you can't have any part of a voting system connected to the internet. Voters Choice Act, which is a discretionary provision where counties can either opt in or not opt in, requires real-time access to poll books. Only way to do that's on the internet. That's a contradiction. We think it should be resolved in favor of the controlling provision, the older provision in the Elections Code, which would kick the Voters' Choice Act. You can read about that lawsuit. We'll put a link in our description. Our new lawyer, Deborah Pauly, actually wrote that. Have we even done the podcast since hiring Deborah?
I don't think we have. When was she hired?
That is crazy.
Was it sometime
in August last year?
Okay. Yeah. No, our last one, which I know because I watched a little bit of it to remind me what we were doing last time. Our last one was the July 4th episode. So it's been
a long time. Okay. We've got a lot of new cases. I'm not going to be able to keep track of which ones are new and which ones aren't.
Yep.
We're participating on an election challenge up in Shasta County. Now that's a new one, just originated this week. And then a lot of ours have been favorably resolved as well. We won a lot of the cases we were previously litigating. Again, I don't remember what months we won those. So we'll have to save that update for our next episode, which is going to be our Supreme Court update episode. So I think those kind of go hand in hand.
You
won't have to wait months and months for this one. But we did want to talk about some of the big developments that have happened of late in the Supreme Court. But maybe we'll introduce Deborah in the next episode. But yeah, we have another lawyer who works here now as an associate attorney. Deborah Polley, who's a longtime fixture in the conservative activism movement in Southern California. We are very pleased to have her. She's been doing great work with us. Maybe we'll hear from her next time. Yep. But anyway, what's on our agenda today, David?
We are going to finally wrap up after, what is it, 10 months, our series on Jeremy Bentham. You may recall.
I guess he killed the podcast, right? It's
pretty much, yeah.
we should have just put up an image of each of our preserved heads and said, you know, if you don't have the podcast, at least the preserved head can keep you company.
Yeah. As we learned from our great idol Jeremy. Previously, did we actually?
I don't remember.
If we didn't, this is just a little bit of a taste of what kind of a guy he was like.
Yeah. So keep in mind, sorry to interrupt you, David, but to preface this, Jeremy was writing on social theory, right?
Yes. Yes.
Presumably this guy knows a thing or two about how people interact, the sorts of things people would find appealing, especially because, you know, he came up with utilitarianism. Remember, father of utilitarianism, greatest happiness principle, greatest happiness to the greatest number of people.
Yeah.
So to have that sort of a theory and be at all respected, one would expect you to understand the kinds of things that tend to make people happy.
You'd think. But
so with that preface, tell us about Jeremy's head, David.
While he was still alive, you know, he didn't die because he was decapitated. That happened later, just to, you know, clarify. But while he was still alive, some acquaintances came and said, oh, you know, when you're gone, we'll miss you. And he thought, well, that's stupid.
That's strange.
Yeah.
Why would they?
You can just have my preserved body around and you can look at it if you ever miss me. And that's just as good, right?
Then you won't miss me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I'll still be there.
I forget which school it is.
Google tells me that it's the University College London. Just
there you go.
Yeah. FYI.
But one of the institutes of higher education in London is currently in possession of his head.
That's right.
And I remember at some point last year, I was looking for information about him, and I came across sort of a puff piece. Someone at that school wrote a top 10 list, things you didn't know about Jeremy Bentham. One of the items was, contrary to popular belief, no one has ever played soccer with his head. And
who thought that?
I do not know. I think they were running out of steam because some of those.
That was not the purpose of the preserved head. It was not for playing soccer. It was for keeping people company.
Yeah, much more rational.
I think anyway, he told the story about how his nephew wanted him to meet some friends of his. And he said, well, why would I want to meet them? He says, well, I think you'd enjoy their company. And he said, well, if I would enjoy their company, then I would be sad when they're gone. So there's no reason to meet them.
Yeah. And if I wouldn't enjoy their company, then it'll be miserable to hang out with them to begin with. So no, I will not meet these people.
Yeah. So either way, I shouldn't meet them. Yeah. A very logical man. Obviously, we know he had his criticisms of Blackstone. There are really two, just as a refresher, there are really two competing schools of what law is fundamentally in modern Anglo-American, what do you want to say, like broadly accepted notions about what law is. One is the one that comes from Blackstone. It's kind of funny because they were at least rough contemporaries, Blackstone and Bentham. Bentham was a little bit later, one generation later. But Blackstone's theory is that laws are rooted in some kind of unchangeable, unchanging constant. They're rules of action that are, you know, built into the fabric of reality, ultimately created by God, expressed in his law, but also expressed through things that we see around us. And you can usually infer them from the manner in which humans interact with each other. Like, you know, life has value. Yeah. Therefore, the taking of life is something that's legally prohibited. And the civic law should reflect this natural law. And to the extent that it does that is the extent to which that law is just. Jeremy Bentham disagrees with that fundamentally.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say he disagrees with the concept that law ought to be just, right? Because when we're talking about justice, we're talking about right and wrong. And Jeremy Bentham does not believe in right and wrong. Instead of addressing those concepts, he sort of sidesteps the question and says, it's not about what's right or what's wrong. It's about what causes pleasure or pain.
Yeah.
And if things cause pain on a broad scale to lots of people or lots of pain to a few people, those things should be disapproved of and should be discouraged by the law. And things that cause pleasure to lots of people or cause lots of pleasure to some people, presumably, those things should be encouraged by the law. So law no longer becomes about preventing wrong and allowing right. It becomes about promoting pleasure and discouraging displeasure.
Another way to put it.
And I think in the past episode, we got into the many absurdities that are implied by that and how, you know, how can you actually quantify, like, what if it makes me really, really happy to go around, I don't know, poking babies?
Yeah. Well,
how do you quantify that against like the sadness? Yeah.
Basically, yeah. You have to ignore that possibility to make things like that work. And a sort of rule of thumb for how to categorize the way people are talking about law and political systems is, if they're talking a lot about rights, they're probably in the Blackstone tradition. And if they're talking a lot about utility, advantage and disadvantage, they're basically Bentham or Benthamites anyway.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. So if you thought, like, you know, this law would be good because it'll make society better for people, or it'll improve our standard of living, or you know, whatever it may be, those people are probably benthamic, and should be despised.
I'm trying to think. I know the second episode we did on him was all about his response to the Declaration of Independence. That was the 4th of July one. In the first one, we must have done...
Oh, yeah, that was miserable.
We must have done the Panopticon and his sort of more general philosophy. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Anyway, you shouldn't despise them. I was hoping David would correct that. You should educate them. You should tell them that their view of law is myopic and limited, and that it's actually at odds with the Western tradition and the legal system that was put in place in England and America that really goes back thousands of years.
Yeah.
You know, Blackstone stands at the precipice of a very long tradition. He's not originating ideas. He's just trying to codify and put together things that are already in the English law. That's the important thing to know about him.
Yeah.
Jeremy really just kind of made this stuff up. And, you know, in his typical fashion, he likes to reduce things to numbers. That's a big passion of his. You'll see that today when we talk about his methods of policing. Yeah. But those are the two kind of views that the average American has about law. And it bleeds into the penal system, too. You know, there's a big debate about whether penology should be about rehabilitation or whether it should be about punishment. Punishment's kind of a word that has negative connotations. But I think certainly our penal system should be about giving people what they are due.
Right.
I mean, and that's kind of the concept. And if you're not actually due the deprivation of your liberties, I think it's fundamentally radically unjust just to deprive somebody of their liberty for social utility because you think society is better off with them behind bars. I think that's actually pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
If we can't say that it is right to do that, then we shouldn't be doing it.
Right. People, you know, the big rhetorical point for people who favor rehabilitation theory is that, you know, punishment is just sort of a mean sounding word. We don't want to punish people. That's
Foucault's real argument.
Right. But the counter argument is, okay, if this person doesn't deserve punishment, why are you locking them in a cage for a certain period of time? That's horrendous.
Right. Well, and that's the real risk of utilitarianism, right? Is that it has zero respect. I mean, there's no line that you can't cross. Right. I don't want to say it has zero respect for rights, but it doesn't regard them as rights. They're not things that are inviolable. Any line can be crossed as long as you can show that there's a good reason to do it and that it's going to benefit lots of people.
Yeah, which, as we'll see in a minute, is basically the way he thought about police and the way, really, a lot of people have come to think about police.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, Jeremy Bentham was a lawyer before he decided he was going to become a social theorist. He was not a very good lawyer, by his own admission, because he found the law confusing and complicated, which is why he decided to revise it. And rather than having a bunch of rules that you have to learn and understand how to apply, he just said, let's just figure out what makes people the happiest.
Yeah. And as a reminder,
it's a lot more arbitrary.
His plan for an actual legal code was to logically determine every kind of situation that could possibly arise and then make laws addressing each of those logical cases. So that's the
If Anakin Skywalker from episode 2 had been a lot more of a train enthusiast, I think that he would have shared some commonalities with Bentham.
Well put. I suppose we should probably actually turn to the main topic, Bentham on police. And one of the questions...
Do we have like an intro clip for that?
Do you have one? Oh, the guillotine. I forgot about that. Yes. Thank you.
That just says transition two, but I guess it's a guillotine. Sure.
Yes, it's a guillotine. I think we...
this is our guillotine.
That's definitely a more explicit guillotine. Anyway, you may be wondering why it's important to talk about Bentham in connection with police. That probably seems a little bit far-fetched, but one of the reasons is that he was actually pretty directly involved in the creation of the first quote-unquote modern police force.
Part of that's because he was very good friends.
Yeah.
I don't know how he became friends with him, but was very good friends with the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, a guy by the name of Robert Peel. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, this bumbling, incompetent fool had the ear of the Prime Minister of England at an extremely pivotal time in their history. See, England's, I think you got to remember about England, is they've got a little bit of an inferiority complex when it comes to the rest of Europe. You know, on the one hand, they know that they're better than the rest of Europe, right? Absolutely. I mean, they're on their island set apart from the rest, and they know that they're ahead of the rest of Europe. But on the other hand, it sometimes doesn't seem that way. And you know, people like to make fun of them. They say their taste in art is bad. They say their food is terrible. Mm-hmm. For good or ill, the French, the Italians, they kind of like to make the English feel like country bumpkins. And the English, knowing that they are better than the French and the Italians, don't like to be made to feel like country bumpkins. So when France has, very much so. So when France has a revolution in 1789, and England's sitting over here, and we still have a king, and we've lost one of our most important colonies, and you know, fundamentally didn't understand their arguments for why they left, and think that has to do with the king, we think that maybe France is doing something new and flashy that we're not a part of, and that we don't understand.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of change going on in Britain at this time because they feel like they've got to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah. You get all your fashion choices from Paris. Why not your politics, right? You know, let's go hand in hand.
Yeah. Politics is just fashion of a different sort, right?
Yes, exactly.
And if there's one thing you know about the French, the French love numbers, right? They love math, science. They like to reduce everything to 10. You can listen about that in our Summer of the Revolution series from a couple of years ago. And well, lo and behold, we've got a guy over here in England that also seems to like to reduce things to numbers and likes to count in tens. Mm-hmm. It doesn't use those old arcane legal rules. And lo and behold, this guy has the ear of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
So in this period of radical social change, often influenced by the way things are done on the continent, they end up coming to this guy.
Yeah. What a lot of people, I think, don't understand about policing and the sort of the sense of a police force is that it's actually very modern, all things considered. There was nothing equivalent to a sort of, you know, city police department and NYPD, whatever until the 19th century.
David, when I play Skyrim, and I'm in, what's it called, Whiterun? Is that one of the cities?
It's been a long time since I played that game, but that sounds right. And I'm sure we're coming off as extremely cool having this conversation.
So I'm playing that game, and I decide that I'm going to steal something in Whiterun.
Yeah.
I get rushed by guards.
Yeah.
And those guards arrest me. How is that different from a police force?
There's actually a number of ways that's
Skyrim's a medieval game, right? Take a step back. It's set in the Middle Ages, obviously not perfectly accurate. It's a fantasy world, but
right. We
have this basic conception that there were town guards like that in the medieval era, right? I mean, somebody enforced the law.
Yes.
So what is that versus what is a police force?
Probably the main thing that distinguishes them is whether you react to a crime that's been committed. You know, something brings a crime to your attention, you respond, you try to apprehend the criminal. Or, on the other hand, you could go out and be among the people and try to catch people doing crimes, try to suppress crime by being around and watching everything. That's
before they are committed.
Yes. So if you
like in Minority Report.
Exactly. I was going to say, if you've seen Minority Report, this might sound a little bit familiar. That's pretty much the fundamental question in that movie. And as we'll see, that comes up in the context of modern policing as well.
Why is that integral to a police force? Again, I want to distinguish here. What makes something a police force versus the way that it used to be done? And how did it used to be done?
Yeah, well, a number of ways. For one thing, it was a legal responsibility for people in English towns to alert people if they observed a crime. You know, they called it hue and cry. You see someone, you know, steal something, you're supposed to make a fuss about it, get people's attention. And then, you know, the town itself has responsibility for apprehending the criminal. Another way that could work was
who would do it for the town, though? Like, didn't they have some force they'd employ to do that?
Sort of. They could be appointed by a court official or a justice of the peace, who were a sort of officials appointed by the king to have responsibility for different regions. Sheriffs were introduced as well, who had responsibility for justice.
So historically, you know, in the common law, there's this thing called the police power, right? And that predates police forces. Power is held by, it's held by the citizenry. Yeah. It's not held by the government. It's held by the citizenry. And it's exercised on behalf of the courts of law.
Yeah, actually, I learned this that I thought was interesting. It's police is just sort of one option for a Greek word that could also be translated as policy or polity.
Yep.
Like it's all just sort of to do with
polis.
Yeah. The general public order.
Yeah. You didn't think you were going to get Alligator Alley today, but
it's all
rooted in polis, which is, you know, the word used for city, metropolitan. Yep. It's in that.
Yeah.
But all that has to do with the social order, right? So the police power is the power to maintain the social order.
Right.
And that's exercised by the people. Historically, it's always possessed by the people. Now, as we know, if we know anything about John Locke or anything about Thomas Jefferson or our history, the people often delegate their powers to others, right? That's the basis of Republican self-government, right? Is that our representatives exercise power that we've given them on our behalf. But the power is still ours, and we're supposed to maintain authority over its exercise. We cannot irrevocably delegate away our power, just as, you know, Congress can't irrevocably delegate their power away to the president. And that's rooted in the fact that we, the people, are the ultimate possessors of that power.
Yeah.
So if you hire like a town sheriff and that sheriff forms a posse, that sheriff and that posse are both exercising power on behalf of the people.
Yeah.
That's power the people fundamentally possess that they have now hired someone else to do for them. How's a police force different from that, David?
Because the police is a government institution as opposed to one that is sort of directly receiving its authority from the people. It's independent exercise of the police power by the state without consulting the people.
That's right. So it's typically answerable to a city council, not to the people directly. It's also, you know, I would say at least structurally in theory, it is the same, because that's what, you know, you have to justify it within our legal system however you can. But when was the last time you felt like you called the shots with the police force?
Yeah, never. Literally never.
Literally never. Yeah. And it's and the big difference, at least in exercise of that power, is, as David mentioned, police forces are groups you like to have standing around. You don't just have a sheriff that forms a posse when he needs it. The posse is always there, right? They're on the government's payroll. And why would you always need the posse there? Is it because you always see criminals who are committing crimes, you're trying to apprehend them? No, I don't think so. The posse is always there because they want to prevent crime.
Exactly.
They don't want to apprehend people who've already committed them. They want to see when crimes are being committed and be able to get them right away. Or better yet, if you just have patrol cars or you know, a police officer on his beat going around an area, maybe their presence will discourage the crimes from even being committed.
Intimidation, basically.
Makes sense, right? That's logical.
Yeah. to a certain point. But the question is,
at what point, David?
Well, and again, this is where Bentham's particular views come into play. Most concretely, the way Bentham gets involved in all this is that he's acquaintances with a guy named Patrick Colquhoun, who's a Scottish merchant with a lot of business interests in London. And they said, you know, we're tired of things being stolen from the docks on the Thames River. We're losing money this way. We need to do something about this. So they draft a letter to basically a business consortium of people with interests on the Thames. And they say, let's hire a bunch of guys to just cruise up and down the river, and we'll try to stop people from stealing so much of our stuff, which they do.
And which is reasonable, right?
Yeah.
That's private. That's like hiring a security guard or exactly. Hiring a security guard firm.
Yeah.
That's very reasonable. We got no issue with that. You have every reason to want to protect your own stuff. And if your stuff is commingled with others, you have every reason to get together with those folks and hire someone to do that. That's not the police power at this point.
That's fundamentally like a mall cop or something. You know, he's just
it's a guard.
Yeah.
You're hiring guards.
Yeah.
And guards and police are not the same thing.
No.
When I say police, I mean a person who exercises the police power.
Yeah.
The police power is the power to apprehend for lawful trial and conviction. It's very different from guarding something, which is to prevent something from being, you know, tampered with by people who don't have any right to it.
Yeah. But at any rate, so this Thames River police is formed, and based on the success or, you know, supposed success, I don't know whether it was actually very useful or not, but it was certainly perceived to be. These merchants started lobbying for, hey, how about we have the whole country work this way, basically, or at least London. And a few decades on, they were folded into the new police force that was created under Peel by what's called the Metropolitan Police Act. And actually, fun fact.
So they got nationalized.
Yeah. Robert Peel is the reason English policemen are called Bobbies. Fun fact. Bobby Peel.
Yeah, because he's Robert Peel. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just like the fact that I oppose, and this is my own political opinion, although it's also a constitutional opinion, the fact that I oppose nationalization of healthcare does not mean that I oppose healthcare.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
The fact that I oppose nationalization of guard services or absorption into the municipality of guard services does not mean that I oppose guard services.
Right. Yeah.
It's confusing that with the police power. That's the problem.
They do sort of fundamentally nationalize, although actually it's even slower than that because of how strange this concept seemed to English people. It started with, I think, London, specifically what's called the City of London, mm-hmm. sort of the historical core of London. And I think a radius of 10 miles initially, and then that was sort of gradually expanded over the rest of the 19th century until fundamentally it became a national police service.
Which becomes the first, what they call modern police force. And what they mean by modern police force is basically they exercise that dual role of they guard and they have exclusive power to enact the police power. So like to arrest and apprehend for crimes, do both of those things. Which is only possible because they're part of the government now. But it becomes the first so-called modern police force in the English-speaking world. Now, there were such a thing already in France, is it right?
More or less. The gendarmes, who had, among most English people, a pretty unsavory reputation, which is one of the reasons there was opposition to this whole scheme.
You may remember French police being satirized in the film Casablanca, where Claude Rains plays a very corrupt police official. This was a stereotype that was very widespread in English-speaking culture for centuries.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons people didn't like this idea was they thought, well, these are government agents who are just going to be sort of around all the time looking for people doing things wrong. How is this not just spying on the populace? And, that remains an excellent question.
Yeah, but you can see how a lot of the police model that ends up being implemented is based sort of on French roots, right? Because, it's not divided up into traditional common law jurisdictions. They're divided up into precincts. Yeah. And those precincts usually have straight lines between each other. You know, it's very metric, very French, the way that that's been done.
Yeah, it's, you're forming police departments. You know, the name
yes.
is pretty indicative of bureaucracy. And among other things...
We just call it a sheriff's office traditionally over here.
Yeah. Among other things that the subsequent Metropolitan Police Acts did was establish the right for the police to decide to open new precincts, appoint new commissioners, and so on. Sort of, it became self-perpetuating.
On their
basically.
Own?
Yeah. Within budget.
Oh, good.
But, yeah, at the discretion of the overall police commissioner.
Well, at least we don't have that here.
Yeah.
Or do we? How does that work?
You know, I think that's probably, maybe even municipality by municipality. But, you know.
You're probably right.
We absolutely have an overabundance of police precincts. I don't know how many hundreds are in New York City alone, but it's a lot.
Well, I know I was just reading the other day about, what was it called? I sent you the stuff on this, David, about how New York used to, or I guess still does have, like an intelligence division.
Yeah, yeah. The
after 9/11, they realized the federal government wasn't doing enough to prevent terror. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the international branch of the New York Police Department. And that was created on their own authority. City Council had no power over that. They couldn't check anything they were doing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that they were investigating people of, what have they put it, questionable ancestry or
something like that. I may have that nearby. I can find it. Definitely something about
from a horribly inflammatory way of yeah. referring to people.
Let me see.
Suspect ancestry, wasn't it?
That's ancestries of interest. So it sounds a little friendly.
Ancestry.
But yeah, interest. What that means is that they were going to spy on people who were from the wrong parts of the world.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which they did, and then admitted later that that had never produced a lead that they could actually use. But, you know.
Every mosque within a 100-mile radius of New York had investigators from this division of the New York Police Department in it.
Yeah.
If I were the mayor of one of those other cities that had a mosque in it, I would be pretty upset that they were violating our jurisdiction on that.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Who knows? Anyway, eventually the ACLU got wind of it and did something about it.
Yeah.
So anyway, police departments definitely do have a lot of power to establish their own divisions, their own precincts, things of that nature.
Yeah. And you can see probably already some of the connection between the way Bentham thinks about things in general and the way police conduct themselves. But if it isn't clear, to put it explicitly, the idea being if you can prevent something bad from happening, it's like doing something good. So if you're doing that all the time, you're increasing the greater social utility just sort of by default.
Yeah.
The big issue with that I see anyway is people have a right to just sort of live their lives without interference unless they've done something wrong, which you see that's the way traditional law enforcement works. You observe a crime, you raise an alarm, the community deals with it. You're presumed to be able to go about your business until there's a reason to think that you've done something wrong, as opposed to police.
Well, you can see how the kind of the over-intrusiveness
yeah.
of... sort of the way that Bentham frames these issues. You know, we saw the same thing with Panopticon, where, yeah. well, if the purpose of prison is to rehabilitate the inmates, and if we're trying to do the most good while they're in prison, then the way that we need to do that is we need to keep track of everything they're doing.
Yeah.
Same thing with social theory. If you want to promote the greatest utility, if you want to have the greatest pleasure to the greatest number of people and promote the most pain to the greatest number of people, well, you need to actually know what people are doing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, your actions don't solely become the interest of the state when you have violated a law, when you have committed a wrong and therefore are acting outside of your rights. You become of interest to the state purely by existing because the state is interested in promoting your happiness and preventing your pain.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that it doesn't seem to have occurred to him that being under constant surveillance, or at least the threat of constant surveillance, might make a lot of people unhappy. But I suppose that's another matter.
Why would being around a dead body make you unhappy, David, yeah. if you were lonely?
Who wouldn't?
I think there are a lot of things that didn't occur to Mr. Bentham.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And
yes, that is an ad hominem. And no, I don't care.
Yeah. He does talk an uncomfortable amount about how being the man in the middle of the panopticon, the one watching everybody, or at least, you know, because you're hidden in the center, he talked about a system of veils. You could be watching anybody. How that would be an enjoyable situation.
It could be.
You might like being the person who gets to watch everybody. So
goodness, what a sicko!
That's,
yeah. I won't even get started on his. Well, we probably shouldn't go down that rabbit hole.
No, you shouldn't. I know what you're talking about, and you shouldn't. And you know, I don't like to over psychologize my approach to history, but sometimes it's just sort of staring at you right in the face.
Sometimes you just can't help it. There's a great book by Paul Johnson called Intellectuals, which, you know, for a while somebody had the idea of we should do a read what we're reading thing for the podcast. Be fun to do Intellectuals at some point, but it's basically an unapologetic ad hominem. The premise is this, that so much of the Enlightenment was motivated by basically personal misconduct of the clergy, that people didn't like that the clergy were greedy, that they were the same sort of material beings the rest of us are, had the same kind of desires the rest of us do. And that so much of the Enlightenment was based on a rejection of them for what they were doing. That, well, why don't we just try to evaluate Enlightenment intellectuals by the same measuring stick? Let's see how well the modern priests live up to what they are preaching. And it looks at guys like Rousseau, guys like Marx, and looks at, you know, maybe these aren't the most stellar examples for us to be basing our entire political economy on.
Yeah. Yeah. Bentham is, I don't know if he's actually addressed in that book or not, but he would be a good candidate for that.
He's
kind
not
of treatment.
No,
anyway.
He's, I think he would be. He has a lot less of the moral vice, I would say, but he's certainly an odd guy.
He's just deeply, deeply weird. And we, as you mentioned, we act on his assumptions about human behavior in a number of ways.
Yeah. Oh, he's not like, and he's not like a normal traditional social theorist that talks about what's right and wrong. Like, I would care a lot less about your concept of what makes people happy if you didn't root things that make people happy and the government's authority and, you know, I guess prerogative duty even to make evaluations, judgments, and legal demands about what makes people happy.
Yeah.
Like, I probably wouldn't complain about that as much if that were not central to your political theory.
Yeah, no. Knowing that you're the kind of guy who is happy when he gets to observe people quietly while hidden, it's a little, you know, suspect.
And it just so happens that your system has a whole lot of observing people quietly while hidden.
Yes, yeah. And bizarrely, while I was doing a little reading on some of the secondary literature about Bentham, I found almost everyone who calls themselves a criminologist and talks about Bentham has nothing but positive things to say about him. It's like, it's astonishing.
Which is probably it's the field that he's least credited with, but it's probably the one where he's most influential. I think the reason he's not really credited with creating much of the modern concept of policing is he didn't write on it.
Right.
You know, it was all just conversations with Peel. But he writes on it indirectly in a lot of his work.
Yeah.
Nothing but positive things to say about him. He improved everything.
Yeah. I've found they're publishing or have recently published a volume of his just sort of notes on policing that they just sort of had to scrape together to make something resembling.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
It's probably one of those books that costs about $250. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. It's, you know, one of those things that they only print a few hundred of and then they just get sold to universities. But
you told me you tried to collect some of his quotes on policing, but they were also,
it's so boring.
Long and syntactically poor.
It's worse, and I didn't think this was possible.
We just couldn't do it.
It's worse than...
This podcast is boring enough. You don't need Bentham quotes in it.
Yeah, it's worse than the stuff he said about law, which, as I mentioned, was all about trying to categorize every logical option for an action. It's more boring than that. And a lot of it just sort of revolves around this idea of trying to prove that preventing something bad from happening is virtually the same as doing something good. So preventing bad things is a good thing. It's just interminably.
It is the same because it prevents the harm.
Yeah, it's just awful. It's truly awful. But I found a few things people had to say about this. It's interesting because they are, as I said, generally very positive about Bentham. Almost none of them directly question him at all, which is shocking for
now. What do they say that's good? Like, what are their positive comments about Bentham? I want to at least give the other side here.
Yeah. So he said, this is from a book called Jeremy Bentham on Police, which is sort of a collection of essays by different people. This is, I'd never heard of any of these people before. So, you know, do with that what you will. A guy named Anthony Braga wrote.
He's just saying they're not famous, so you shouldn't care about them.
Basically, yes. I don't know how many people are following criminology journals or not. Maybe that's someone's hobby. I don't know. But anyway, Anthony Braga.
And we apologize. We're not in this field, so we apologize if we get things wrong.
Right,
but,
right.
You know.
Says Bentham was a highly influential developer of deterrence theory. And as Quinn, and there he's referring to some influential essay, rightly observes, an early proponent of the idea that the police should be focused on crime prevention. So that's sort of the big innovation that's attributed to him.
Yeah, when you got a bunch of guys in uniforms with bats walking around a neighborhood and you know that they'll beat you with those bats if you do things that are wrong, you're less likely to do things that are wrong.
And the word focused there is actually very important. You're talking about focused deterrence because what he has in mind is sort of anti-gang strategies in modern police. But in Bentham's case, he had basically two ideas about how to focus this deterrent effect. One was based on, you know, the location of valuable goods. So the Thames River being an obvious one. That makes sense, sure. And then the other one was basically poor people, because as everyone knows, poor people are the criminals. So you should be watching the poor people.
Yeah, and he's pretty upfront greed.
About that. Yeah, he's very open about
that's where the word villain comes from, right?
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Yeah, we could do an Alligator Alley on that.
Yeah. It's
someone who lives on your villa, right?
Yep.
Specifically poor people living on rich people's property.
Yeah.
Is where the word villain comes from.
Mm-hmm. But
poor people generally not that well thought of in terms of their criminality.
So that's basically the sort of best case. This is the closest thing to a negative comment I saw. And this is by someone named...
It's from a Marxist, isn't it?
I don't know about D. Kim Rosso, but maybe, you know, who knows? He or possibly she, Kim could be either, says, in order to prevent future events, analysis and forecasting is required. Any attempt to predict, however, invariably involves false positives. The more distant the future event, the greater the potential error rate. Judges and parole boards struggle to make decisions on someone's relatively short-term future behavior. Long-term predictions of criminality are not much better than guesses. And they're drawing out some of the... Again,
that seems right. That's why it's bad to target the poor. That person's not a Marxist. That person's good. that's why it's bad to target the poor areas when looking for crime. You can't just assume that because somebody doesn't make very much money that person's going to be a criminal. That is horrifically unjust. And what laws are, you know, maybe this is mind-blowing here, but that's sort of what laws are designed to prevent.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So that rather than being a respecter of persons, we are a respecter of laws.
And you hear, or should hear, I hope, the resonances with Minority Report, as we talked about, this idea about projection, and police are increasingly trying to use statistical profiles to sort of determine who's likely to be a criminal. You can, you know, do your own reading on that. There's plenty of it out there. But it also reminds me...
I think we talked a couple months ago about that AI program in Oregon look to for their child protective services, where they would look at who was likely to be abusing children and then only investigate those people based on statistical algorithms about...
Something along those lines.
Patterns in their lives or whatever.
Yeah, which is horrifying. Yeah. But this also reminds me... This is something that the NYPD has openly sort of said, this is our strategy, something called broken window policing, which is sort of the theory that if you live in a rundown place, you won't respect the law, so you'll become a criminal. So to prevent real crimes, like serious things from happening, what we need to do is just clamp down instantly on any minor disruptions, things like loitering, disturbing the peace, graffiti, that suppressing those things, trying to really bring the hammer down on people who are doing those things is the best way to stop them from doing long-term serious crimes. which just seems.
But that worked, didn't it?
It worked on preventing. Yeah, I mean, like being,
that's credited with the fact with.
It certainly prevented broken windows. You know, the rate of graffiti and.
I thought that was dead. That policy was largely attributed for the huge decrease in crime that New York had.
They may be attributing it. I would question that assumption, among other reasons, because the statistics tend to indicate that people who are jailed or otherwise involved in being punished by the law tend to be the ones who commit serious crimes in the future. But, you know, anyway, we don't need to go into our own version of statistical projections, but it certainly means that a lot of people are going to be hassled by police a lot more often for things that don't necessarily need to be a big deal.
That's sort of the opposite of what's happening in Los Angeles right now, where Gascon won't prosecute people who shoplift or any of the rest of that.
Well, I was going to say there's an important distinction. You know,
he would make that argument based on social utility, too, is that these people, largely because of, you know, Bentham style policing, certain demographic groups have been unjustly targeted by law enforcement disproportionately. And to, I guess, counterbalance for that, you need to make sure the laws are not enforced against them. Yeah. But if we'd get rid of this, you know, predictive winter crimes going to occur, and we would just, when we see crimes occur, actually arrest people, bring them in, arraign them, try them, and sentence them, you'd have the same effect.
Yeah. And what I was going to observe about that sort of broken windows concept, there's basically two ways that a crime has negative effects, right? It can be a personal injury to someone, whether that's their body or their property, right? Or it can disturb the peace, the sort of the public order that we were talking about, what the police power is about. Things like broken windows and abandoned buildings really don't do either of those things. You know, it's not harming.
Well, if it's somebody else's building.
Yeah, yeah. Abandoned buildings specifically is what we're talking about here. Like,
but what if I own an abandoned building that I keep abandoned because I like it that way? And then somebody starts breaking the windows in my abandoned building.
Well, then you could make a report about it because it has personally injured you.
I think that's correct.
As strange as that might be. Yeah. You could make a report about it because it has affected you.
Yeah, I think that's the correct way to. And then once I've made a report about that, if the police were not engaged on actively patrolling everywhere to prevent crime, maybe they'd have the manpower to be able to investigate my crime and find the person that did it. Exactly. Especially when I give them the video surveillance and show the license plate. Exactly. And, you know, all the rest of that.
Yeah, but this sort of crime suppression doesn't really do anything for that. It's not likely, you know, if someone hurts you, steals from you, attacks you, etc., assuming you survive, you probably will tell somebody about it, right? You'll bring it to the attention of someone who's responsible for it. Or even if you die, presumably your family or somebody will be disturbed at the sight of this corpse and report it.
But But the direction you've noticed police forces going, and this is rooted in Bentham's concept of what policing ought to entail, is you don't see much work on the back end at all. Yeah. I think most of us have at some point reported a crime. And if we didn't already know that that crime was extremely unlikely to go investigated, we very quickly thereafter learned that it was not going to go investigated. You know, you were informed by the police officer, we never catch the criminals who do this sort of thing. The trick is preventing the crime before it happens. That's the common mantra you always hear in these cases.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's.
I had my car broken into a couple of years ago, and they said, you know, we're not going to find it. And I said, the stuff that was stolen was pretty unique stuff. You know, they're going to be fencing this somewhere. I don't have the manpower to go to every pawn shop in my neighborhood and figure out where they're fencing this stuff. But you do. I mean, it would take like three guys to do that.
Yeah. Whose job it is to do stuff like this, you know, every day.
Not that it's the most important crime to investigate. No. But my point is investigation of crimes has largely been replaced with preventing crimes.
Yeah. You will.
Sorry. Our lag is horrible. So I keep interrupting you. You said something in the middle of that.
I was just going to observe some comedian. I remember making a joke about, you know, it's like, oh yeah, all these people talking about how much they hate cops. Well, let's see what happens when you need someone to show up 7 hours late to a crime and say there's nothing they can do about it. But that is a very typical response.
Yeah, it's almost regarded as once the crime has occurred, it's too late, is sort of the attitude. And that's just that's true if you're a guard.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. There's obviously a place for guards. And guards have failed if the guy gets in and the guy commits the crime. That's not at all true of somebody who's exercising the police power.
Right.
Exercise of the police power exclusively deals with crimes that have already taken place. These are separate things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying either of them shouldn't happen. I think you should have guards who are preventing crimes from taking place. And I think you should have people who are then, you know, rounding up and interrogating suspects after the fact.
Yeah.
But when you combine those things, I think one ends up happening to the detriment of the other. And the one that we've seen with modern policing, in fact, I would say the hallmark of modern policing is replacing that investigation and prosecution for criminality with prevention of criminality.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's based on this.
That's even what Gascon's doing here. I mean, people say Gascon doesn't prosecute any crimes. How can you be a DA if you don't prosecute any crimes? And they've forgotten that they ought to be right. You know, that ought to be a correct intuition. But most of what DAs now are doing is not prosecuting crimes. It's working with police departments to prevent crimes from happening.
Yeah. And again, this is based.
And it's not working too well for him. I can tell you that.
No. And it's based in large part on this sort of almost quasi-mathematical projection about social utility. The assumption that social utility will be greater if we have this sort of deterrent effect than if we actually respond to things that have gone wrong. And I think that's...
Well, in particular...
Yeah, it's not particularly useful in terms of catching criminals for the reasons we've been talking about. I think it's also not terribly good for social utility because, you know, people feel uncomfortable around cops. That's just sort of a given thing. You know, even if you're not doing anything wrong, you feel a little bit on edge because, you know, this is someone who could make trouble for me. That's a pretty common experience, I think. Definitely, I feel it.
I think most of us get a little bit scared when the cop is driving alongside us for too long.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know,
am I going to commit a traffic violation?
Right. Yeah. Or even, you know, you're in a store when a police officer is there to buy something. You feel a little bit like, make sure this guy knows I'm not shoplifting or something in a way.
I'm not one of the bad people.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are neighborhoods.
The people he's trying to deter.
Yeah, there are neighborhoods, again, these sort of targeted neighborhoods, areas that they think are going to produce criminality, where there's cops around basically all the time. And people there tend not to enjoy that either.
Right. Well, and particularly in a modern context, any social utility that clearly it never, you know, the social utility has always been questionable because people don't really like being intimidated. But whatever social utility it once had, particularly in a modern context, is now mostly absent. Like in Los Angeles, I assume the rest of California, and I know it's happening increasingly in the rest of the country now. There are these, what do they call them? Where they'll hit up a store, big groups of people, and they'll steal tons of stuff all at once.
Yeah.
Smash and grab.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that, David?
Yeah.
Well, that's using traditional Benthamic methods of policing, where you're looking out for suspect neighborhoods or you're looking for places where windows are already broken. This isn't going to work at all because these people are coordinating specifically to hit locations that are not where they live and not in areas they usually frequent.
Yeah.
That's the whole concept behind this. That's virtually impossible to prevent with this kind of preventative policing because people who want to do bad things will continue to do bad things. You only prevent that when you catch them after the fact and punish the perpetrators. And you have to devote serious resources to figure out who they were.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think on a very fundamental level, too, you're not doing something wrong by looking suspicious or something like that. You know, the sort of things that a police officer would actually be acting upon, right? Like, if you just sort of look like you might do something, you've not done anything. And you're right to...
What if you have like a bunch of tattoos though and like a shaved head and you look really frightening?
But, you know, you can have your own personal opinions about that, as in fact I know you do. But I think you'll have to
consider... Is that not a crime though,
David? That person is still within their legal rights to be there, you know?
Yes, I will defend them to the death.
Yes. And, you know, broadly, as I mentioned, there's a sort of presumption that you have you should expect to be able to go about your business without interference unless you've actually done something wrong. That's a pretty basic element.
They have reason to believe you've done something wrong. Yeah. I mean,
nothing's infallible.
They're going to take in suspects that didn't do it.
Right. Yeah. And necessarily, just because human perception and knowledge is fallible. That's unavoidable. That's right. That's granted.
That's why we have trials.
Right. Yeah. Someone has to actually determine the facts after you've been apprehended. That's fair enough. But this sort of idea that it's fine for that sort of peaceable existence to be constantly intruded upon in the interest of keeping you from doing something wrong, I think is just wrongheaded to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be clear, we are not blaming police officers for any of this.
No.
We are blaming Bentham for this.
Yeah.
I hope that's very clear by the name of this episode.
Yeah.
Most police officers I talk to, you know, when I've called them out for crimes and they say there's nothing we can do, we can't investigate it, I don't think they're happy about that fact.
Yeah.
I think people would like to, you know, most people want justice. I think the sort of person that becomes a police officer, all the more so. And justice has to do with making sure that people who commit wrong face the consequences for committing wrong. So, you know, I don't think they're happy about the state of modern policing. But I do think that the state that it's currently in, what it's evolved into, really is a result of some of its inception, really all the way back to London.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we then started implementing this in New York and then throughout the rest of the country.
Yeah, exactly. It was the way it was set up. It was always geared in this direction. And I think we're seeing just sort of natural consequences of that.
Right.
And that
it retained the vestiges of the way that policing had been done and should be done in Anglo-American jurisprudence. But those vestiges have gradually eroded, and its foundational purposes, which I think are founded in Bentham, have become all the more prominent, to a point now where crime really is rampant, especially in areas like Los Angeles, and the prevailing social theories have absolutely nothing they can do to prevent it.
Yeah. And I think it's also the same impulse at work behind increasingly invasive approaches to data and communications monitoring and so on. It's that same preventive mentality that lies behind that, I think.
When we mentioned that New York City Police Department Intelligence Bureau, David kind of mentioned offhand, they didn't actually catch anybody. They didn't get any leads to anything.
No.
Most of this mass surveillance doesn't work because people who know they're committing crimes and they're intending to commit crimes generally try not to get caught.
Yeah. Yeah. the example, I thinking about the mosque surveillance, I just thought it was absurd that they expecting one day to go into a mosque and the imam gets up there and he just says, I think people should do terror. Like, what was going to happen in their minds?
You would keep that a secret. Other people and said, hey,
if you were that person, you wouldn't say it in public.
No. No leads. Anyway, I think that about does it for Bentham and the policing. Do you have anything else you wanted to cover on that, David?
I think there were 6 or 7 total Metropolitan Police Acts, but the sort of the fundamental effect of all of them was to make the police increasingly independent of those sort of traditional relationships of accountability that they would have had to either a particular court or a particular community. And they, got more and more leeway to sort of stand on their own. It also centralized. And, I think one of the important things about modern police forces is that they tend to operate on more or less military structure. We even use the same terms for police officers, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, major, colonel, so on. In larger.
Which is also very French.
Yes. Yes, it is.
They even do that with kitchen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have a chef, a chief of the kitchen.
Yeah. It wasn't masculine enough to be a cook. So they had to give everyone military ranks to make it a little manlier. But
I guess.
Yeah. People talk a lot about militarization of police in terms of, the equipment that they're getting, which, form your own opinions on that, I guess. But I think more fundamentally, the fact that they are no longer directly accountable to their own sort of local communities and have these hierarchic structures with officers and sort of a central command, that's more worrisome to my mind than anything about the particulars of equipment.
Yeah. Here's a great quote that you have in here that we didn't read. This is from Peter Joyce and Wendy Laverick from Police Reformers and Police Reform in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. They said, crime prevention was not entirely viewed as a state-administered function, and he, Bentham, identified 25 crime-preventing expedients, ranging from street lighting to registers of travelers, provisions... Registers of travelers, really?
Yeah.
Provision of identifying marks for all subjects of the state, regulation of the sale of poisons, all that annoying crap that you have to deal with is all...
Yeah.
All right. the reason that I have to be over 18 if I want to buy a can of spray paint is because of this guy.
Yeah.
Provision of identifying marks for all subjects of the state. Identifying marks for all subjects of the state.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's a state ID type of thing, but...
Publication of accounts and giving publicity to the proceedings of the state.
Yep.
I don't object to that one.
Yep.
Utilitarian position regarding police reform was not unchallenged. Adam Smith, for example, believed that what entailed a complex and involved system of policing would interfere with the liberty of the individual, especially since state involvement could result in central government using police power to favor a particular interest rather than serving the general good.
Yeah. And, you know, even a step beyond that, police unions have become very powerful political units in and of themselves in modern American electoral politics. And that's...
We got to do our own episode on public unions, David.
Yeah.
They are a menace.
Yes. But even beyond sort of use of law enforcement to target specific groups, which I'm sure people can think of examples both from America and from elsewhere where that can be done. But police unions often have, just like teachers unions, a lot of influence over elections. It's worth noting.
Yeah, and not to suggest the only problems with policing are rooted in Bentham, but today those are just the ones that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I like this statement. This is from your notes, David. Mm-hmm. By the way, David always writes notes for all of these, and they're always fantastic. But you have, it's one of our concluding statements. Philosophically, if evidence of a crime is required for state intervention, i.e. in the form of warrants, trials, or following a guilty verdict punishment, then preventative policing is inherently unjust.
Yeah.
And I think that basically says it.
Yeah.
Preventative police become an interest group, one with outsized influence, and can push for the creation of more and more intrusive criminal codes, which is in fact what has happened and continues to happen. We've seen that amplified again and again with respect to some of the lawfare that's been going on, which we won't get into too much today. But a guy by the name of Harvey Silverglate, who's another one of John Eastman's lawyers working on his cases, a few years ago wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day, which basically is rooted in the premise that our federal criminal code is so broadly written that the average person commits about three felonies a day, just living your daily life. Which makes the question of policing then not become how do we prosecute the people who have committed crimes, but which of those people are we going to care about?
Yeah. And how are we going to get evidence of these wrongdoings if they're ubiquitous, which on that, statistic, they would seem to be.
Right. Well, that's if we have a lot of catch-all crimes where if you see somebody who you know is up to no good, you can get them on things like vagrancy.
Yeah.
You can get, marijuana used to be that in California. I think a lot of the explosion of crime in recent years is because the police no longer have that out, where if they know that you're up to no good, they can't just stop you for possession of marijuana anymore, because they used to just always get you on that.
Yeah.
If they really wanted to get you. But I think, it's not to say we should recriminalize marijuana so that we can get all suspect people. It's to say we should punish crimes that we know have been committed, not go out looking for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, any concluding thoughts, David?
I think we've covered it just about all, but this might clarify what I was saying earlier about the broken windows thing. If you wait for there to be evidence of a crime, you pretty much know that that crime has caused some harm, right? It's either disrupted the public peace or someone has been harmed by it. And so there's something real to redress.
Yeah, someone complained about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you know that it's a crime worth prosecuting because it has caused some kind of damage. there are crimes that can be sort of wrong in themselves, like maybe you shouldn't morally have done them, but they don't actually harm anybody. And certainly in terms of priority, that should be lower, one would think, than something that has actually caused enough harm that someone made a police report. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that we don't get with preventive policing.
Well, I think that's all for today. Again, next time, which may be in a couple of weeks, hopefully in a couple of weeks, we will talk about the Supreme Court's docket and some of the things that have come up there. But for now, that's pretty much all we have for you. So see you later, folks.
Goodbye.